I'm Floyd Hall, and this is a Wonder Root artist feature. I have the pleasure today of chatting with artist Marcia Weitzman. Marcia, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Well, my first question for you, Marcia, is when do you rest? Because you're always on the go. You're always traveling somewhere. And I think to myself, when does she ever stop and just rest?
Well, I do make sure that I have 8 hours sleep per night. I have to have that, otherwise I don't function. But I have like slow moments too. I have I try not to work during weekends. Sometimes it's not possible, but I do believe that it's part of my work to have like slow moments and also rest moments. I practice yoga. And I make sure that I go regularly to my classes. But you're right. I keep myself busy. I don't think of my work as being some kind of like job, like how to say, like a second job or hobby. To work with art for me, it's my main profession. It's what I know how to do. What I want to do, I wake up every day willing to work with my projects and my subjects. So there is not really for me like a drag to work. And sometimes I know other artists talk about that, but sometimes it seems I'm not doing some like a lot, but I am, because I do believe that art is a mental process. So even sometimes when I'm like in a coffee place, and I'm writing or, you know, like chatting, there's some element of work there, because I do observe what's going on around me. I don't think that everything that I do is coming from just myself. I think I'm kind of like a machine of processing meanings. So I'm observing people, reading books. Sometimes the emptiness is also very important for my work, to stop and kind of process all of this information. But you're right, I don't stop. I have like sometimes three different projects going on at the same time. I don't choose when I'm going to show my work. So sometimes I know that the month of October is pretty busy always. It's been a pattern the last 5 years. And it's beginning to develop as a pattern too, that the month of February and March, the months of February and March are very busy too. I don't really know why, but I don't say no to works. So I just keep going.
You mentioned that you tend to have several works in different forms of completion. And it seems like your work is very much a process, in terms of at least how I perceive it. It does not seem as though it's something that's done in a very short amount of time. Could you talk about that length of process of your work, and maybe how you work through getting to a point of completion?
I call what I do projects. I don't work with one medium only. I do like time-based media, audio, video. So when I start thinking about what I'm going to do next, and normally it's kind of like in a confusing, intuitive way, there's some kind of attraction to a theme or to a form. I try to understand what is the perfect medium for that. Sometimes it's not going to be the perfect one, because I do believe that sometimes some things come to my mind and there is not the perfect medium for that yet. But yes, so I need to research sometimes things that I haven't worked with. There was a moment in 2009 that I wanted to work with, again, with broadcast and live TV. But I was not up to date what was going on that time. So I had to go back and research the whole state of broadcasting and TV broadcast. And I decided that I would go back to analog TV. And I made a project called Nocturnal Encounters. It was part of Nuit Blanche in Toronto. And I really, it took me 2 years to research what kind of broadcast, what kind of technology, what kind of message or community involvement I wanted to have inside of that project. I think it was a successful project, but of course it took me in the end some weeks without really sleeping because it needed to work, and it needed to work at that moment. So that's the kind of involvement I always end up having with the project. I think I work a lot as a type of producer or media producer, although my love is for fine arts or for art. I don't see myself working as a commercial video producer or film producer, but I think my working mode is more related to that type of process. It's like I need to develop a film, and I go and I make it possible. In my case, it's not a film itself, but it's a project that is inside of the larger art dialogue or contemporary art dialogue. But I see as well that this has been always the struggle for me, the professional struggle, to be able to keep this working process, this mode, this type of work, and also fit in what people would think is more like a traditional art scene. I wish sometimes, but it's very short, that I could work with images and know that I would have one exhibition per year or two and people know what I do. It's very difficult for me to have this kind of what Americans call the spiel, you know, to say in two sentences what I do. I can't say in two sentences what I do. I can try to establish a dialogue in two sentences, but it's very difficult to say in two sentences what I do, exactly because I think I work in this mode, you know, like different projects, 2 years researching, 1 year researching.
How have you gotten better at bridging that gap between your process as it relates to maybe broadcast and film and the visual component with the what you would call, as you mentioned, this fine art or just art in general, dialogue? How have you gotten better at making that bridge for yourself?
There are in different parts of the world people working in this mode too. It's not something that just belongs to me. There is in Europe a very strong group working what we call the media arts, or in Brazil it's very strong too. I see that in the States it's a little bit less organized. There are artists working with video, there are artists working with sound, but it's less intense that there is like a school for media arts, which includes photographic art, audio or sonic art or video art, but also not just like using this kind of media to represent something, but also talking about the media system. What is the impact of radio? So you work with the media system in fine arts. It's like, you know, if you're working with a theme, I don't know, immigration or racism in fine arts, but you're also observing the media system. I think this is something that is needed in the United States, specifically because the media here, the news media and the film industry, they're so strong that I would wish that this kind of more like experimental media would be also stronger. But of course, there are incredible people here working with that. You know, like there are names that are very strong, like maybe Gary Hill, Coco Fusco. They are not directly talking about media, but they are inserted in this media art context. So I'm not alone in that, but I really need to keep my connections with people everywhere, because it's more fragmented than you would say like the general art, like gallery art scene. So I think Atlanta is very open to this kind of work, but it's also not, for instance, what Cologne in Germany is, that they have, you know, 50 professors working in an art school, you know, with a theme media art or experimental cinema. It's fine. But I really, as I said, I need to keep the contact with all of these places I have been to be able to assure myself that I'm doing the right thing.
Well, let's stay there. Let's talk about where you've been and start with where you're from. You're from Sao Paulo, Brazil. And let's start there and maybe trace your steps in terms of your path from there to Atlanta, because I'm very curious about how you ended up here in Atlanta to begin with. So let's start with Brazil and go from there to here.
Yes, I grew up in Brazil. I was born and grew up in Brazil. My family is already a family of immigrants, as probably 90% of Brazilians are. I'm mixed. I belong to different cultures already. And when I was young, very young, I came to the United States as an exchange student. I lived in Alaska. After that, I lived in many places studying and working. I passed through Austria, Germany, Japan, short period in Finland, short period in Portugal. And then I came back to the States. And I came back to the States because of family reasons. And we didn't know if we would be in Detroit, Phoenix, or Atlanta, and ended up, we came to Atlanta, and I'm very happy about it. My longer periods were actually in Austria and in Germany. So I studied in Germany and Austria, and then I was teaching at the it's a school called KHM. It's Academy of Media Arts. I taught there 6 years undergrad and grad classes for artists. My main role there was computer and video, but mostly like computational art. So how could artists work with programming or editing, a lot of digital stuff. And well, 6 years teaching is a long time, so I see like many periods there too. And teaching there meant also to organize exhibitions, organize exchange, short exchange programs. So we had guests from Japan, from Brazil. I played that role of being the articulator as well. And what happens in Germany is, like, you cannot be an assistant professor for longer than 6 years. You need to have your tenure after that, and you cannot have your tenure in the same school. So when my term was over, I was not sure I wanted to stay there. So I went back and spent 2 years in Brazil, and I think it was a good move. But I still miss a lot Germany. I miss the forum and the dialogue, but I have still good friends there. You're going to cut a lot of stuff, so don't you?
I'm keeping all of that.
Because I can talk and tell a story. You know, I'm kind of a storyteller. You see that, right? Like,
But no, I think that's very interesting, because I think that allows people to see maybe some of... I think that's important because of the context of your work. And I think that people, when they understand where an artist has been, then it maybe helps to give more of a presence to their work when they're viewing that artist's work. Because then you say, oh, well, this person has been in these types of settings, in this role, so maybe that's reflected in their art in some sort of way. But speaking more locally about what you've done recently in Atlanta, you were one of the artists who were a part of the Wonder Root CSA, and you submitted some work for that. So I would love for you to talk about that work. We have actually some pieces of that work here in the studio, so I would love for you to talk about what you did with that and maybe your process.
Okay. So I was very excited about being approached by Wonder Root to submit a project to the CSA project. And I thought about having works that would not actually compete with the works that I have in my gallery, because it seemed for me that it would be a contradiction. So I thought about developing something totally new, and it was also what Wonder Root was expecting, to have something new for the shareholders. And I remembered that I had films that I haven't developed yet, so I had no clue if I had really images on the films or not. Mm-hmm. These films were shot during a large trip to the West to develop to capture a video and sound for a project called Heisenberg Boulevard. And I thought about, you know, the risk of shareholders buying something they haven't seen before and the risk of Wonderroot asking artists to develop works. So I thought about submitting a project that was related to the risk factor itself. So what I submitted to Wonderroot is I have 6 or 7 rolls of films, middle format, made with a toy camera, a Holga, and I don't know if I have something on the films. But if you accept the risk, I'm going to develop a work from what I get back from the development of the films. But I'm not going to develop the films before you accept this. So if you accept my project, I will be sure that I'll, you know, process the films and see if there is something there. If there is not, then there is nothing, right? So Wonderroot really liked the idea of taking risk. And actually, the photos came out pretty good. So I had more than what I expected. I thought I might have like good shots from a ghost town I visited. But it's impossible to know if you have something imprinted on the negatives with Holga. So it was interesting because I took so much equipment to this trip and very expensive stuff. And at the same time, I had this toy camera. You know, so sometimes when I had like a bit of free time, I took the Holga camera out and shot some pictures. So I chose 4 different photographs for the CSA. The first one is Ghost Image Town. It's one of the photographs at a ghost town in California. And I was very excited about it because months before I had been in an exhibition in São Paulo. We opened 5 solo exhibitions at the same time at the Centro Cultural São Paulo, Cultural Center São Paulo. And all the solo shows had something common. They were somehow related to the idea of photography and phantom images or ghosts or images that were not there, although they have been captured by some kind of photographic device. So when I saw that my photographs from the ghost town came out well, I was very happy. But I was hesitant to choose 4 different photos from the same roll because I also had different exciting photographs from other rolls that I shot during the trip. So I have Ghost Image Town, that's this first one. Las Vegas, Last Stop, because the last night was spent in Las Vegas. Shana Riley and I, my project partner, we had to stop in Las Vegas because we were driving already 5,000 miles. And it was very exciting to have the Holga in that environment of light after almost a month in the desert or in almost isolation. Millions of Bryce Ears is the next one. It's a very particular photograph. It's hard maybe for people to understand why I chose that. It's a photograph that is long on the negative because I advanced the film in a way that it's kind of like scanning the landscape at the same time that it's being exposed. It's very abstract, and you see lines, like residual lines on the film. There's from this kind of advancing movement. And I really like that because at the same time that you look at Bryce Canyon and you see the lines of millions of years of sediments there, you see the lines of my attempt to record time on the negative. I know it's a very subtle idea in a short moment, but I really like this idea of, you know, these vertical lines on the top of the sediment lines of Bryce. And then the last one is sulfur steam. And it was an attempt to photograph smell, although I know this is impossible. But the feeling I had that moment as a kind of like an artist trying to use the whole body as antenna and as tool was that I needed to try to have something that would be related to the smell of sulfur. It was in Wyoming, in one of the moments at Yellowstone, that at Yellowstone Park, that the smell of sulfur was so overwhelming that I just photographed for photographed, and it's kind of like a negative that has like one photo on the top of the other. It's very confusing, and it was the way I was kind of feeling that moment. I could never imagine how overwhelming the smell of sulfur can be in this kind of volcanic environment. That was the first time actually I was in a real active region. Of course, I've lived in Japan for a while, and it's the whole land is active, but it's not active in this way. So I had visited places where the water would smell like sulfur, or it would kind of taste like metal, but I never felt this cloud of sulfur around me as I felt at Yellowstone. So I talk a lot about this kind of, you know, attempt to photograph something that you know is impossible to photograph, which is the smell, right? So these are the four works I have put on the box, in the boxes, and I'm very happy about it. What I wanted was, in the end, to make like pins of places I had been during this trip. And I think it was successful because, you know, you have like a bit of California, a bit of Nevada, a bit of Wyoming, Utah. But at the same time, you would not recognize really that these photographs were made in these places.
You talked about risk in that project, and both with the shareholder and both with you and your toy camera. I feel like risk is a pretty strong sentiment in a lot of your work. Talk about risk in maybe a larger context as it relates to your work.
I love the idea of taking risks. And to do that, you really need to put yourself in a position of having nothing to lose. There is a lot of reduction there. And it took me a long time to be able to see myself as an artist that has nothing to lose. You know, it's like that I don't want to be attached to anything I have done before. So it's easy for me to do something that might be risky and might not work, because I see that as being something that is worth it. There are many projects I try to develop, or I begin to develop, or I think I will develop, that they're not successful. And I'm fine with that. The risk is what keeps people moving forward. So I don't want to put people in risk, and I don't want to work with the type of sensationalist risk or do extreme things to offend people. That's not the kind of risk I work with. I don't mind if people work that in that mode. I don't care. Some things I like, some things I don't, as the public. But in my case, it's like I do believe that sometimes I make mistakes and I make like wrong assumptions about things, but I don't mind, because I always put myself in that context, and I understand exactly why I remember exactly why I made decisions I made. So there are moments, for instance, 2004, I was in Japan, and I went back to the islands where my grandparents are from, and that was the moment that I went back to making videos. I hadn't worked with moving pictures in the more traditional way for years, that moment. And it was very, very risky for me at that moment to go back and do something linear. It's a 15-minute documentary, kind of like conceptual documentary. And I made some wrong technical decisions for that work, and I still see that. But it's one of the works that every time I watch it, I get emotional. We just screened that in Georgia State University like a month ago, more or less. And I was in the public, like I was sitting with the public. And at the end of the screening, I felt emotional. I was like, I saw tears rolling down. And I don't like to express this kind of, you know, feelings in public or anything, but I couldn't hold it back because it's still very strong. So I still see, as I said, the technical mistakes I made that moment, which are like the least important. Sometimes they're big mistakes, you know, like, I don't know, some exhibition that you really wanted to work with a kind of material, it worked halfways. But it's fine. I have always the hope that I'm going to revisit the work in the future, or that I'm going to be tolerant to myself too, knowing that was the only thing I could do. So there was this project that I was talking about, the broadcast in Toronto. I was sure I was going to have like this fantastic kind of like circle stand on the top of the work, you know, like holding the rain and the wind out, and people would be relaxing. And it didn't work. In the end, I had all the equipment, like open air, outdoors, and I was just praying that it was not going to rain. And actually, it didn't rain. So actually, it began to rain like 6 in the morning, and the work would be over at 7, so we just cut 1 hour from the whole broadcast. But this is a big risk, because if you're willing to broadcast 12 hours and it would rain like after it started, the work would just not be possible. Right. Let me see if there are other big risks I can't talk about. There was a project I was developing with a community in Brazil, a community called Dandara. They occupied a piece of land in Brazil. And this was 2 years ago. I traveled to Brazil. I had a cameraman, because normally when it's more like research, I don't want to be doing the camera myself. I had a cameraman, fantastic one. And I interviewed many of these people from the 1,000 families that occupied this piece of land. And it was for a large exhibition, and my work got censored. I'm not ready to talk about it really, but I tell you, that was one of the biggest risks I assumed, and it didn't work. And I still need to work with the community to explain to them what happened. But I needed time to not put them in risk, because there is a lot of violence going on around this community. And I didn't want to use them at all to promote my work. So I don't want to be like I know it exists, like censorship, and we just had a case in Atlanta which was very strong. But I didn't want to be the artist that was censored. I just wanted to move on for a while. But now it's beginning to be time to contact them again and, you know, send them some material and explain exactly what happened. At that moment, I thought, I'm going to give up. I can't do this anymore. There are moments in the career that, you know, it's just like they're difficult. And then but I had a lot of help from many people. And I wrote the letters that I was supposed to write. And I decided not to go public because I would put them in a more, dangerous situation. So,
are you still surfing?
You know, I'm dreaming of surfing. Every time, like, I'm screening to see if I find some documentary about anything, I stop like surfing. I want to go back to surfing this summer. I'm not a super surfer. You know that. I'm a super hobbyist surfer, but I enjoy that. And I try to explain to people why I enjoy that. It's like I enjoy more to wait for the perfect wave then to surf, it's to surf. Of course, the surf is like a high point, you know, like when you stand up and you feel that everything is harmonic, it's great. But this thing of the waiting, the observing, you observe the movement, the counting, it's like this kind of like low mathematics of, you know, waiting. Yeah. Okay, one wave, two, three. They're not really a perfect one. And then you see one coming like very far away and you're like, okay, this might be the one. And sometimes you don't really know that the perfect wave is so close to you because it's been formed right there. So you risk to. So there is this movement that it's hard to explain to people that never tried to surf, because it's not just about that perfect image that you see on the video, you know, like, oh, the perfect. It's a lot about patience and observing and the silence, you know, like I love when I'm like feeling the vibration of the wave on the board when you're beginning to ride it, you know, it's like there is this movement. It's safe at the same time because you see it's stable if it's a good wave, but at the same time there is this kind of violence there that you never know where it's going to take you. So it's awesome. So I want to try to surf this summer, I think in North Carolina. I'm researching. I got some names already. But as I told you, I'm like, you know, those people that learn how to do something when they're older, and, you know, I enjoy it. And that's the most important point for me. So.
Marcia Weitzman, let everyone know how they can learn more about your work and what you have going on.
I have a website that I try to keep simple, and, you know, I have 8 projects there only. It's www.marciavaitsman.com. It's www.marciaweitzman.com. And my email is listed there, so if anybody wants to contact me per email, I answer all my emails. I don't screen, and I don't like the silence. I answer everything. So feel free to contact me and take a look. And I don't normally list there my exhibitions, but I need to begin to do that. So I might have like a kind of news on the website soon.
Marcia, obrigado.
Oh, de nada. Muito prazer. Thank you very much. This was very cool.
Thank you as well.